You remember. I found myself standing at the front of the house, sir, where the flowers were. I felt quite dizzy and had a headache. I was thinking, I must open the window. But that was foolish, as I was already outside. It must have been about 3 o'clock. Mr. Kinnear was coming up the driveway in his light wagon, all new painted, yellow and green. McDermott came out from the back, and we both helped with the packages. And McDermott gave me a threatening look, and then Mr. Kinnear went into the house, and I knew he was looking for Nancy. A thought came into my head. You won't find her there. You will have to look below. She is a carcass. And I became very frightened. Then McDermott said to me, I know you will tell, and if you do, your life is not worth a straw. I was confused by this. What have you done? I said. You know very well, he said with a laugh. I did not know, but now I suspected the worst. Then he made me promise I would help to kill Mr. Kinnear, which I did say I would, for if not, I could see by his eyes he would have killed me as well. Then he took the horse and wagon to the stable. I went into the kitchen to go about my duties as if nothing was wrong. Mr. Kinnear came in and asked where was Nancy. I said she had gone to town in the stagecoach. He said that was strange, as he'd passed it on the way and did not see her. I asked him if he would like something to eat, and he said yes, and asked, had Jefferson come with the fresh meat? And I said no. He said that was curious, and then said he would have some tea and toast and eggs. And so I made it. I brought it to him in the dining room, where he sat waiting, reading a book which he had brought with him from town. It was the newest Godey's Ladies book, which poor Nancy liked to have for the fashions. And although Mr. Kinnear always pretended it was only ladies' fripperies, he himself often took a peek at it when Nancy was not nearby, as there were things in it other than dresses, and he liked to look at the new styles of undergarments, and to read the articles on how a lady should behave, which I would often catch him chuckling over on those occasions when I brought in his coffee. I went back into the kitchen, and McDermott was there. He said, I think I'll go and kill him now. But I said, good gracious, McDermott, it is too soon. Wait till it is dark. Then Mr. Kinnear went upstairs and had a nap with all his clothes on, and so McDermott had to wait, whether he wanted to or not. Even he was not up to the shooting of a sleeping man. McDermott stuck to me all afternoon as close as glue, because he was certain that I would run away and tell. He had the gun with him and kept fiddling with it. It was the old double-barrel shotgun that Mr. Kinnear kept to shoot ducks with, but it was not loaded with duck shot. He said he had 2 lead bullets in it, one he'd found, the other he'd made from a piece of lead, and that he got the powder for it across the way at his friend John Harvey's, although Hannah Upton, a hard-faced bitch, she was the woman who lived with Harvey, had told him he couldn't have it, but he'd taken it anyway and be damned with her. By this time he was very excited and nervous and swaggering as well, and proud of his own daring. He was cursing a good deal, but I did not object to it, being afraid. About 7 o'clock, Mr. Kinnear came down and had his tea, and was quite uneasy about Nancy. Now I will do it, said McDermott. You must go in there and ask him to come into the kitchen so I can shoot him on the stone floor. But I said I would not. He said in that case he would do it himself. He'd get him to come by telling him there was something wrong with his new saddle. It was all cut to ribbons. I wanted nothing to do with it. I took the tea tray across the courtyard to the back kitchen, which was the one with the stove lid, as I was going to do the washing up in there. And as I was setting down the tray, I heard the report of a gun. I ran into the front kitchen and saw Mr. Kinnear lying dead on the floor, and McDermott standing over him. The gun was on the floor. I attempted to run out, and he yelled and swore, and said I must open the trap door in the hall. I said, I won't. He said, you shall. So I did, and McDermott threw the body down the stairs. I was so frightened that I ran out of the front door and onto the lawn, and around past the pump to the back kitchen. And then McDermott came out of the front kitchen door with a gun and fired at me. And I fell onto the ground in a dead faint. And that is all I can remember, sir, until much later in the evening. Jamie Walsh testified that he came into the yard about 8 o'clock, which must have been right after you fainted. He said McDermott still had the gun in his hand and claimed to have been shooting birds. I know it, sir. He said you were standing by the pump. He said you told him that Mr. Kinnear was not back yet and that Nancy was gone over to the Wrights. I cannot account for it, sir. He said you were well and in good spirits. He said you were better dressed than usual and were wearing white stockings. He implied they were Nancy's. I was there in the courtroom, sir. I heard him say it, although the stockings were my own. But by then he had forgotten all of his former loving sentiments toward me and only wished to damage me and to hang me if possible. But there's nothing I can do about what other people say. Her tone is so dejected that Simon feels a tender pity for her. He has an impulse to take her in his arms, to soothe her, to stroke her hair. Well, Grace, he says briskly, I can see you are tired. We will continue with your story tomorrow. Yes, sir. I hope I will have the strength. Sooner or later, we will get to the bottom of it. I hope so, sir, she says wanly. It would be a great relief to me to know the whole truth at last. The leaves of the trees are already taking on an August look, lusterless, dusty, and limp, although it isn't yet August. Simon walks back slowly through the wilting afternoon heat. He carries with him the silver candlestick. He didn't think to use it. It's dragging on his arm. In fact, both of his arms hold a curious tension, as if he's been pulling hard on a heavy rope. What was he expecting? The missing memory, of course. Those few crucial hours. Well, he hadn't got it. He finds himself remembering an evening long ago when he was still an undergraduate at Harvard. He'd gone to New York on an excursion with his father, who was still rich then, and also still alive. They'd seen the opera. It was Bellini's Sonnambula. A simple and chaste village girl, Amina, is found asleep in the Count's bedroom, having walked there unconsciously. Her fiancé and the villagers denounce her as a whore, despite the Count's protests, which are based on his superior scientific knowledge. But when Amina is seen walking in her sleep across a perilous bridge, which collapses behind her into the rushing stream, her innocence is proven beyond a doubt, and she awakes to restored happiness. A parable of the soul, as his Latin teacher had pointed out so sententiously, Amina being a crude anagram for anima. But why, Simon has asked himself, was the soul depicted as unconscious? And even more intriguingly, while Amina slept, who was doing the walking? It's a question which now holds implications for him which are far more pressing. Was Grace unconscious at the time she claimed, or was she fully awake, as Jamie Walsh testified? How much of her story can he allow himself to believe? Does he need a grain of salt, or two, or three? Is it a real case of amnesia, of the somnambulistic type? Or is he the victim of a cunning imposture? He cautions himself against absolutism. Why should she be expected to produce nothing but the pure, entire, and unblemished truth? Anyone in her position would select and rearrange to give a positive impression. In her favor, much of what she's told him accords with her printed confession. But is that really in her favor? Possibly it accords too well. He wonders if she's been studying from the same text he himself has been using, the better to convince him. The difficulty is that he wants to be convinced. He wants her to be Amina. He wants her to be vindicated. He must be careful. he tells himself, he must draw back. Looked at objectively, what's been going on between them, despite her evident anxiety over the murders and her surface compliance, has been a contest of wills. She hasn't refused to talk, far from it. She's told him a great deal, but she's told him only what she's chosen to tell. What he wants is what she refuses to tell, what she chooses perhaps not even to know. Knowledge of guilt, or else of innocence. Either could be concealed. But he'll pry it out of her yet. He's got the hook in her mouth, but can he pull her out? Up, out of the abyss, up to the light, out of the deep blue sea. He wonders why he's thinking in such drastic terms. He means her well, he tells himself. He thinks of it as a rescue, surely he does. But does she? If she has anything to hide, she may want to stay in the water, in the dark, in her element. She may be afraid she won't be able to breathe otherwise. Simon tells himself to stop being so extreme and histrionic. It may well be that Grace is a true amnesiac, or simply contrary, or simply guilty. She could, of course, be insane, with the astonishingly devious plausibility of the experienced maniac. Some of her memories, especially those of the day of the murders, would suggest a fanaticism of the religious variety. However, those same recollections could as easily be interpreted as the naive superstitions and fears of a simple soul. What he wants is certainty, one way or the other, and that is precisely what she's withholding from him. Perhaps it's his methods that have been at fault. Certainly his technique of suggestion has not been productive. The vegetables have been a dismal failure. Perhaps he's been too tentative, too accommodating. Perhaps something more drastic may be in order. Perhaps he should encourage Jerome DuPont in his neuro-hypnotic experiment and arrange to witness it himself and even choose the questions. He distrusts the method. Still, something new might emerge, something might be discovered, which he's so far been unable to discover by himself. It would at least be worth trying. He reaches the house and fumbles in his pocket for the key, but Dora opens the door for him. He regards her with disgust. A woman so porcine, and in this weather so distinctly sweaty, should not be permitted out in public. She's a libel on the entire sex. He himself has been instrumental in bringing her back to work here. He's practically bribed her to do it. But this doesn't mean he likes her any better than he ever did. Nor she him, judging from the venomous look she gives him out of her small red eyes. "Herself wants to see you," she says, jerking her head towards the back of the house. Her manners are as democratic as ever. Mrs. Humphrey was strongly opposed to Dora's return, and can hardly bear to be in the same room with her, which is not surprising. However, Simon had pointed out that he cannot be expected to function without tidiness and order, and someone must do the work of the house, and as no one else was to be had at the moment, Dora would have to do. As long as Dora was paid, he'd said, she would be tractable enough, although politeness would be too much to expect, all of which has proven to be the case. "Where is she?" says Simon. He shouldn't have said she. It sounds too intimate. Mrs. Humphrey would have been better. "Lying on the sofa, I guess," says Dora with contempt. "Same as always." But when Simon enters the parlor, still eerily bare of furniture, although some of the original pieces have mysteriously reappeared, Mrs. Humphrey is standing by the fireplace, with one arm and hand draped gracefully over the white mantelpiece, the hand with the lace handkerchief. He smells violets. "Dr. Jordan," she says, breaking her pose, "I thought you might care to dine with me tonight as a poor recompense for all the efforts you have made on my behalf. I do not like to seem deficient in gratitude. Dora has prepared a little cold chicken." She enunciates each word carefully, as if it's a speech she has memorized. Simon declines with as much politeness as he can summon. He thanks her very much, but this evening he is engaged. This verges on the truth. He has half accepted an invitation of Miss Lydia's to join a party of young people in a rowing excursion on the inner harbor. Mrs. Humphrey accepts his refusal with a gracious smile and says that they will do it another time. Something in the way she's holding her body, that and the slow deliberation of her speech, strikes him as odd. Has the woman been drinking? Her eyes have a fixed stare, and her hands are trembling slightly. Once upstairs, he opens his leather satchel. Everything seems in order. His three bottles of laudanum are there. None is emptier than it should be. He uncorks them, tastes the contents. One is almost pure water. She's been raiding his supplies. God only knows for how long. The afternoon headaches take on a different significance. He should have known. With a husband like that, she was bound to seek out a crutch of some kind. When in funds, she no doubt buys it, he thinks. But cash has been scarce, and he has been careless. He ought to have locked his room, but now it is too late to begin. There is, of course, no way he can mention it to her. She is a fastidious woman. To accuse her of theft would be not only brutal, but vulgar. Still, he's been taken. Simon goes on the rowing trip. The night is warm and calm, and there's moonlight. He drinks a little champagne, there only is a little, and sits in the same rowboat as Lydia, and flirts with her in a half-hearted way. She at least is normal and healthy, and pretty, too. Possibly he should propose to her. He thinks she might accept. Cart her home to propitiate his mother. Hand her over. Let the two of them work on his well-being. It would be one way of deciding his own fate, or settling his own hash, or getting himself out of harm's way. But he won't do it. He's not that lazy or weary. Not yet. 10. Lady of the Lake. We then commenced packing up all the valuable things we could find. We both went down into the cellar. Mr. Kinnear was lying on his back in the wine cellar. I held the candle. McDermott took the keys and some money from his pockets. Nothing was said about Nancy. I did not see her, but I knew she was in the cellar. And about 11 o'clock, McDermott harnessed the horse. We put the boxes in the wagon and started off for Toronto. He said he would go to the States and he would marry me. I consented to go. We arrived at Toronto at the City Hotel about 5 o'clock. Awoke the people, had breakfast there. I unlocked Nancy's box and put some of her things on, and we left by the boat at 8 o'clock, and arrived at Lewiston about 3 o'clock. Went to the tavern. In the evening we had supper at the public table, and I went to bed in one room and McDermott in another. Before I went to bed, I told McDermott I would stop at Lewiston, and I would not go any further. He said he would make me go with him, and about 5 o'clock in the morning, Mr. Kingsmill, the high bailiff, came and arrested us and brought us back to Toronto. Confession of Grace Marks, Star and Transcript, Toronto, November 1843. He meets, by heavenly chance express, the destined maid. Some hidden hand unveils to him that loveliness which others cannot understand. His merits in her presence grow to match the promise in her eyes, and round her happy footsteps blow the authentic airs of paradise. Coventry Patmore, The Angel in the House, 1854. What McDermott told me later was that after he'd fired the gun at me and I'd fallen down in a dead faint, he pumped a bucket of cold water and threw it over me and gave me some water with peppermint to drink, and I revived immediately and was as good as new and quite cheerful, and stirred up the fire and cooked supper for him, which was ham and eggs, with tea after and a shot of whiskey to steady us. And we ate it together with a good will and clinked our glasses and drank to the success of our venture. but I can't remember any of that at all. I could not have acted so heartlessly, with Mr. Kinnear lying dead in the cellar, not to mention Nancy, who must have been dead too, though I didn't know for certain what had become of her. But McDermott was a great liar. I must have lain unconscious for a long time, for when I woke up the light was already fading. I was lying on my back, on the bed in my own bedchamber, and my cap was off, and my hair was all disarranged and down about my shoulders, and also it was damp, and the upper part of my dress as well, and that must have been from the water that James had thrown over me, so that part, at least, of what he said was true. I lay there on the bed trying to remember what had happened, as I couldn't recollect how I'd got into the room. James must have carried me in, for the door was standing open, and if I'd walked in by myself I would have locked it. I meant to get up and latch the door, but my head was aching and the room was very hot and airless, and I fell asleep again and must have tossed restlessly, for when I woke the bedclothes were all rumpled and the coverlet had fallen onto the floor. This time I woke suddenly and sat bolt upright, and despite the heat I was in a cold sweat. The reason for it was that there was a man standing in the room looking down at me. It was James McDermott, and I thought he had come in to strangle me in my sleep, having killed the others. My voice was all dried up in my throat with terror, and I couldn't speak a word. But he said, quite kindly, "Did I feel better now after my rest?" And I found my voice again and said I did. I knew it would be a mistake to show too much fear and to lose control of myself, for then he'd think he couldn't trust me or depend on me to keep my nerve, and would be afraid I would break down and begin crying or screaming when there were others present and tell everything, which was why he had shot at me. And if he thought that, he would do away with me as quick as winking, rather than have any witness. Then he sat down on the side of the bed and said, "Now it was time for me to keep my promise." And I said, "What promise?" And he said, "I knew very well, for I had promised him myself in exchange for the killing of Nancy." I could not remember having said any such thing, but as I was now convinced he was a madman, I thought he had twisted round something I had indeed said, something that was innocent enough, or only what anyone would say, such as I wished she was dead and that I would give anything for it. And Nancy had been very harsh with me from time to time, but that is only what servants are always saying out of their master's hearing. For when you can't answer back to their faces, you must give vent to your feelings in some other way. But McDermott had turned this around to mean what I never intended, and now he wished to hold me to a bargain I hadn't made. And he was in earnest, as he put a hand on my shoulder and was pushing me backward onto the bed. And with the other hand he was pulling up my skirt, and I could tell by the smell on him that he'd been into Mr. Kinnear's whiskey, and heavily, too. I knew that the only way was to humor him. "Oh, no," I said, laughing. "Not in this bed. It is too narrow and not at all comfortable for two people. Let us go to some other bed." To my surprise, he thought that was a fine idea, and said it would give him great pleasure to sleep in Mr. Kinnear's bed, where Nancy had so often played the whore. And I reflected that once I'd given in to him, he would consider me a whore as well, and would hold my life very cheap indeed, and would most likely kill me with the axe and throw me into the cellar, as he had often said a whore was good for nothing but to wipe your dirty boots on, by giving them a good kicking all over their filthy bodies. So I planned to delay, and to put him off as long as I could. He pulled me to my feet, and we lit the candle that was in the kitchen and climbed the stairs, and then we went into Mr. Kinnear's room that was all tidy and with the bed neatly made up, as I had done it myself that very morning. And he threw back the covers and pulled me down beside him. And he said, "No straw for the gentry, nothing but goose feathers for them. No wonder Nancy liked to spend so much time in this bed." And for a moment he seemed overawed, not by what he'd done, but by the grandeur of the bed he was in. But then he fell to kissing me and said, "Now, my girl, it's time," and began unbuttoning my dress. And I remembered that the wages of sin is death, and I felt faint. But I knew that if I fainted I was as good as dead, with him in the state he was in. I burst into tears, and I said, "No, I can't, not here, in a dead man's bed. It isn't right with him in the cellar, stark and stiff." And I began to sob and cry. He was very annoyed and said I must stop at once or he would slap my face for me. But he did not. What I had said had cooled his ardor, as they say in books, or as Mary Whitney would say, he'd mislaid the poker. For at that moment Mr. Kinnear, dead as he was the stiffer man of the two of them. He pulled me up off the bed and yanked me down the hallway by one arm, and I was still wailing and howling for all I was worth. "If you don't like that bed," said he, "I shall do it Nancy's, for you are as great a slut as she was." And I could see which way the wind was blowing, and I thought my last hour had come, and I expected at any moment to be thrown down and dragged along by the hair. He flung open the door and hauled me into the room, which was in disarray, just as Nancy had left it, for I hadn't tidied the room, there being no need, and indeed no time to do so. But when he pulled back the coverlet, the sheet was all spattered with dark blood, and there was a book lying there in the bed covered with blood also. At which I let out a scream of terror, but McDermott stopped and looked at it and said, "I'd forgotten about that." I asked him what in heaven's name it was, and what it was doing there. He said it was the magazine that Mr. Kinnear had been reading, and he'd carried it with him out to the kitchen where he was shot, and in falling he'd clapped his hands to his breast, still holding the book, and it therefore received the first spurts of blood. And McDermott had thrown it into Nancy's bed to get it out of sight, and also because it belonged there, having been brought from town for her, and also because Kinnear's blood was on Nancy's head. For if she had not been such a bloody great whore and shrew, all would have been different, and Mr. Kinnear needn't have died. So it was a sign. And at that he crossed himself, which was the only time I ever saw him do anything so papist. Well, I thought him as mad as a moose in heat, as Mary Whitney used to say. But the sight of the book had sobered him up, and all notions of what he'd been about to do had gone right out of his head. And I held the candle down close and turned the book over with my thumb and finger, and it was indeed the Godey's Lady's book, which Mr. Kinnear had so enjoyed reading earlier in the day. And at this memory I nearly burst into tears in earnest. But there was no telling how long McDermott's present mood would hold. So I said, "That will confuse them. When they find it, they will not be able to guess at all how it came there." And he said, "Yes, it would give them something to puzzle their brains over." And he laughed in a hollow sort of way. Then I said, "We had better hurry, or someone may come while we are here. We must make haste and pack up the things, for we will have to travel by night, or someone will see us on the road with Mr. Kinnear's rig, and will know something is wrong. It will take us a long time to reach Toronto," I said, "in the dark, and also Charlie Horse will be tired, having made the trip once today already." And McDermott agreed, as one half asleep, and we commenced searching through the house and packing up the things. I did not want to take very much, only the lightest and most valuable items, such as Mr. Kinnear's gold snuff box, and his telescope and pocket compass, and his gold penknife, and any money we could find. But McDermott said that in for a penny, in for a pound, and he might as well be hanged for a goat as for a sheep. And in the end we ransacked the house, and took the silver plate and candlesticks, and the spoons and forks and all, and even the ones with the family crest on, for McDermott said they could always be melted. And I looked into Nancy's box and at her dresses, and I thought, there's no need for them to go to waste. Poor Nancy has no further use for them. So I took the box and all in it, and her winter things, too. But I left the dress that she'd been sewing because it seemed too close to her altogether, as it was not finished. And I'd heard that the dead would come back to complete what they had left undone, and I didn't want her missing it and following after me. For by this time I was almost certain she was dead. Before leaving, I tidied up the house and washed the dishes, the plates from supper and all, and I put Mr. Kinnear's bed in order and pulled the coverlet up over Nancy's bed, although I left the book in it, not wanting to get Mr. Kinnear's blood on my hands. And I emptied her chamber pot, as I did not think it a nice thing to leave, as being somehow disrespectful. And meanwhile McDermott was harnessing Charlie and loading the boxes and carpet bag into the wagon, though one time I found him sitting outside on the step and staring vacantly in front of him. So I told him to pull himself together and be a man, for the last thing I wanted was to be stuck there in that house with him, especially if he'd gone completely out of his mind. And when I told him to be a man, it had an effect, for he shook himself and got up and said I was right. The last thing I did was to take off the clothes I'd been wearing that day, and I put on one of Nancy's dresses, the pale one with the white ground and the small floral print, which was the same one she had on the first day I came to Mr. Kinnear's. And I put on her petticoat with the lace edging, and my own spare clean petticoat, and Nancy's summer shoes of light-colored leather, which I had so often admired, although they did not fit very well, and also her good straw bonnet. And I took her light cashmere shawl, although I did not think I would need to wear it as the night was warm. And I put some rose water behind my ears and on my wrists from the bottle of it on her dresser, and the smell of it was a comfort of sorts. Then I put on a clean apron and stirred up the fire in the summer kitchen stove, which still had some embers left in it, and burnt my own clothes. I didn't like the thought of wearing them ever again, as they would remind me of things I wished to forget. It may have been my fancy, but a smell went up from them like scorching meat, and it was like my own dirtied and cast-off skin that I was burning. While I was doing this, McDermott came in and said he was ready, and why was I wasting time? I told him I could not find my large white kerchief, the one with the blue flowers on it, and that I needed it to keep the sun off my neck while we would be crossing the lake on the ferry the following day. At that he laughed in an astonished way, and said it was downstairs in the cellar, keeping the sun off Nancy's neck, as I ought to remember, seeing as how I myself had pulled it tight and tied the knot. At this I was very shocked, but did not wish to contradict him, as it is dangerous to contradict mad people. So I said I had forgot. It was about 11 o'clock at night when we set out. A beautiful night, with enough of a breeze to be cooling and not too many mosquitoes. There was half a moon, and I couldn't remember whether it was waxing or waning, and as we went down the driveway between the rows of maples and past the orchard, I looked behind me, and saw the house standing there all peaceful and lighted up by the moonlight, as if it was gently glowing. And I thought, who would guess from looking at it what lies within? And then I sighed and readied myself for the long drive. We went quite slowly, even though Charlie knew the road, but he also knew that this was not his true driver and that there was something amiss. For several times he stopped, and would not go forward until urged with the whip. But when we'd gone several miles along the road, and were past the places that he knew best, he settled into it. And along we went, past the fields all silent and silvery, and the snake fences like darker braid alongside, with the bats flickering overhead, and the dense patches where there was woodland, and once an owl crossed our path, as pale and soft as a moth. At first I was afraid we would meet someone we knew, and they would ask where we were going on such a furtive errand, but there was not a living soul. And James became bolder and more cheerful, and started talking about what we would do when we reached the States, and how he would sell the things and buy a small farm, and then we would be independent, and if we did not have enough money at first, we would hire ourselves out as servants and save up our pay. And I said neither yes nor no, as I did not intend to stay with him any more than a minute once we were safe across the lake and among people. But after a time he fell silent, and there was only the sound of Charlie's hoofs on the road and the rustling of the slight wind. I thought I might jump down from the wagon and run off into the woods, but I knew I would not get far, and even if I did, I would then be eaten by the bears and wolves. And I thought, I am riding through the valley of the shadow of death, as it says in the psalm. And I attempted to fear no evil, but it was very hard, for there was evil in the wagon with me, like a sort of a mist. So I tried to think about something else, and I looked up at the sky, which did not have a cloud in it, and it was filled with stars, and it seemed so close I could touch it, and so delicate I could put my hand right through it like a spider web spangled with dewdrops. Then as I looked, a part of it began to wrinkle up, like the skin on scalding milk, but harder and more brittle and pebbled like a dark beach or like black silk crepe, and then the sky was only a thin surface like paper, and it was being singed away, and behind it was a cold blackness, and it was not heaven, or even hell, that I was looking at, but only emptiness. This was more frightening than anything I could think of, and I prayed silently to God to forgive my sins. But what if there was no God to forgive me? And then I reflected that perhaps it was the outer darkness, with the wailing and the gnashing of teeth, where God was not. And as soon as I had this thought, the sky closed over again, like water after you've thrown a stone, and was again smooth and unbroken and filled with stars. But all the time the moon was descending and the wagon was moving along. And gradually I became drowsy, and the night air was cool, so I drew the cashmere shawl around myself, and I must have nodded off asleep and let my head fall against McDermott, for the last I remembered was the feel of him settling the shawl tenderly around my shoulders. The next thing I knew, I was flat on my back on the ground in the weeds at the side of the road, with a heavy weight on top of me holding me down, and there was a hand feeling up under my petticoats, and I began to struggle and to scream. Then a hand came over my mouth, and the voice of James said angrily, "What did I mean, causing such an uproar? Did I want us to be discovered?" I became quiet, and he took away his hand, and I told him to get off and to let me up at once. Then he was very angry, for he claimed I had asked him to stop the wagon so I could get down and relieve myself by the roadside, and having done so, that I had spread out my own shawl not 2 minutes before and had invited him to join me on it like the hot bitch I was, at the same time saying I would now fulfill my promise. I knew I had done no such thing, having been sound asleep, and I said so. And he said he would not be made a fool of, and I was a damned slut and a demon, and hell was too good for me, as I had led him on and enticed him and caused him to damn his own soul into the bargain. And I began to cry, not feeling I deserved such hard words. And he said crocodile tears would not avail this time, as he'd had a bellyful of them. And he proceeded to wrench at my skirts, holding my head down by the hair, so I bit him hard on the ear. He roared out, and I thought he might kill me there and then. But instead he let go of me, and got up, and helped me up as well, and said I was a good girl after all, and he would wait until he had married me, as it was better that way and more proper. He had just been testing me. Then he said I certainly had good strong teeth, as I had drawn blood, which seemed to please him. I was much surprised at this, but said nothing, as I was still all alone with him on an empty road with many miles to go. And so we went on through the night, and at last the sky grew lighter, and we reached Toronto a little after 5 in the morning. McDermott said we would go to the city hotel and rouse the people up and make them cook breakfast for us, as he was almost starved with hunger. I said that was not a good plan, and we should wait until many people were about, as if we did as he said, we would be very noticeable and would be remembered. And he said, why must I always be arguing with him? It was enough to drive a man into a frenzy. And he had money in his pocket which was as good as the next man's, and if he wanted a breakfast and could pay for it, then he would have it. We did as he said. Not so much for the breakfast, I now believe, but because he wanted to show me who was master. What we had was bacon and eggs, and it was a wonder to see how he strutted and swaggered and ordered the servant about and said his egg was not well enough cooked. But I could scarcely eat 2 bites. I was shivering with apprehension because of all the attention he was calling to himself. Then we found that the next ferry did not leave for the States until 8 o'clock, and we would have to wait in Toronto another 2 hours or so. I felt this was very dangerous, as Mr. Kinnear's horse and wagon were sure to be known by some in the town, as he had come there very often. So I made McDermott leave the wagon in the most out-of-sight place I could find on a small side street, although he wanted to drive it about and preen himself. But I later found that despite my precautions it had been noticed. It wasn't until the sun had come up that I got a good look at McDermott in a bright light, and realized he had got Mr. Kinnear's boots on. And I asked, did he take them off the body, as it lay in the cellar? And he said, yes, and the shirt, too, was Kinnear's, off the shelves in his dressing room, as it was a fine one and better quality than any shirt he'd ever owned. He thought to take the one off the body as well, but it was covered in blood, and he'd thrown it behind the door. I was horrified, and asked how could he do such a thing, and he said, what did I mean, as I was wearing Nancy's dress and bonnet myself? And I said it was not the same thing, and he said it was, and I said at least I had not taken the boots off a corpse, and he said it made no difference, and in any case he hadn't wanted to leave the corpse naked, so he dressed it in his own shirt. I asked which one had he put on, Mr. Kinnear, and he said it was one of those he'd bought from the peddler. I was distressed, and said, now Jeremiah will be blamed, as it will be traced, and I would be sorry for that, as he was a friend of mine. McDermott said much too close a friend, in his opinion, and I said, what did he mean by that? And he said that Jeremiah had looked at me in a way he didn't like, and that no wife of his would be allowed to hobnob with any Jew peddlers, and gossip with them at the back door and flirt in that way, and if she did, he would black her eyes and knock her head about her shoulders for her. I was becoming angry, and I was on the point of saying that Jeremiah was not a Jew, but even if he was, I would marry a Jew peddler any day rather than marry him. But I knew that if we had a quarrel it would not be to the good of either, especially if it came to slaps and screaming. So I held my tongue, for it was my plan to get safe across to the States without incident, and then give McDermott the slip and be quit of him. I told him to change his costume, and I would do the same, for if people came asking after us, it might throw them off. We did not think that would happen, at least until Monday, for we did not know that Mr. Kinnear had invited some friends to Sunday dinner. And so I changed my dress at the City Hotel, and James put on a light summer jacket of Mr. Kinnear's, and he told me with a bit of a sneer that I looked very elegant, and quite the lady with my pink parasol and all. Then he went to get himself shaved, and this was the moment I could have run for help. But he had several times told me that we must hang together or we would hang separately, and although I felt myself innocent, I knew that appearances were against me. And even if he was to be hanged, and I not, and even though I desired no more of his company and was afraid of him, still I did not wish to be the means of betraying him. There's something despicable about betrayal. And I'd felt his heart beating next to mine, and, however undesired, still it was a human heart, and I did not wish to have any part in stilling it forever, unless I should be forced to it. And I reflected as well that in the Bible it is written, "Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord." I did not feel it was my place to take such a serious thing as vengeance into my own hands, and so I stayed where I was until he came back. By 8 o'clock we were on board the steamer Transit, with the wagon and Charlie horse and the boxes and all, and pulling out of the harbor, and I was much relieved. The day was fair with a fine breeze, and the sun sparkling on the blue waves. And by this time James was in high spirits and very proud of himself, and I was afraid that if he got out of my sight he would go about boasting and strutting in his new clothes and showing off Mr. Kinnear's gold trinkets. But he was eager to keep me in view in case I should tell someone what he had done, and he stuck by me like a leech. We were on the lower deck because of Charlie, as I didn't wish to leave him alone. He was nervous, and I suspected he'd never been on a steamer before, and the noise of the engine and the paddle wheel going round must have been frightening to him. So I stayed with him and fed him crackers, which he loved because of the salt. A young girl and a horse will always attract attention from admiring youths, who will pretend to be interested in the horse. And soon we did, and I found myself having to answer questions. James had told me to say that we were brother and sister, and had left our unpleasant relations with whom we had quarreled, so I chose to be Mary Whitney, and said that he was David Whitney, and we were on our way to Rochester. The young fellows did not see any reason why they should not flirt with me, as James was only my brother, and so they did. And I thought it my part to return their sallies with good humor, though it told against me at the trial. And at the time I got some black looks from James, but I was only attempting to allay suspicion, both theirs and his. And underneath my show of happiness I was very downhearted. We stopped at Niagara, but it was nowhere near the falls, so I was unable to see them. James went ashore and made me come with him, and he ate a beefsteak. I did not take any refreshment, as I was nervous the whole time we were there, but nothing happened, and we went on. One young fellow pointed to another steamer in the distance and said it was the Lady of the Lake, a United States vessel which until recently was thought to be the fastest boat on the lake, but she had just lost a trial of speed race to the new Royal Mail Standard boat, the Eclipse, which outran her by 4 minutes and a half. And I said, didn't that make him proud? And he said, no, because he had a dollar bet on the lady. And all present laughed. Then something came clear to me which I used to wonder about. There is a quilt pattern called Lady of the Lake, which I thought was named for the poem, but I could never find any lady in the pattern, nor any lake. But now I saw that the boat was named for the poem, and the quilt was named for the boat, because it was a pinwheel design, which must have stood for the paddle going round. And I thought that things did make sense and have a design to them if you only pondered them long enough. And so perhaps it might be with recent events, which at the moment seemed to me entirely senseless, and finding out the reason for the quilt pattern was a lesson to me, to have faith. Then I remembered Mary Whitney reading that poem with me, and how we would skip through the dull courtships and move on to the exciting parts and the fighting. But the place I recalled best was the poor woman who'd been stolen away from the church on her wedding day, kidnapped for a nobleman's pleasure and had gone mad with it, and wandered about picking wildflowers and singing to herself. And I considered that I too was being kidnapped, after a fashion, though not on my wedding day, and I feared I might end up in the same plight. Meanwhile, we were coming into Lewiston. James had attempted to sell the horse and wagon to those on board against my better judgment, but he asked far too low a price, which aroused suspicion. And because he'd offered them for sale, the customs officer in Lewiston put a duty on them and detained them because we did not have the money to pay it. But although James was angry at first, he soon passed it off as being of little importance and told me we would sell some of the other things and come back the next day for the rig. But I was quite anxious about it, as it meant we would have to spend the night there. And although we were in the United States and should think ourselves safe as we were in a foreign country now, yet that had never stopped the slavers up from the States from seizing runaway slaves they said were theirs. And altogether it was far too close for comfort. I tried to make him promise not to sell Charlie Horse, though he could do as he liked with the wagon. But he said, horse be damned! And I believe he was jealous of the poor horse because I was so fond of him. The scenery in the United States was much the same as that of the countryside we had just come from, but it was indeed a different place, as the flags were different. I remembered what Jeremiah told me about borders and how easy it was to cross them. The time when he had said that to me in the kitchen at Mr. Kinnear's seemed very long ago and in a different lifetime. But in reality, it was just over a week before. We went to the nearest tavern, which was not a hotel at all, as was said in the broadsheet poem about me, but only a cheap inn by the wharf. There James soon swilled down a lot more beer and brandy than was good for him, and then we had supper, and he drank yet more. And when it was time to retire, he wanted us to pretend we were man and wife, and to take a room together, for, he said, it would be half the cost. But I saw what he was after, and said that as we had started on the boat as brother and sister, we could not change now, in case any remembered us from the boat. So he was given a room with another man in it, and I had one to myself. But he tried to push his way into my room, saying we would be married soon enough anyway, and I said we would not, and I would sooner marry the devil himself than him, and he said he would have my promise off me anyway. Then I said I would scream, which would be a different thing in a house full of people than in one with only two corpses. And he told me for God's sake to shut my mouth, and he called me a slut and a whore. And I said he should think of some new words to use, because I was heartily tired of those. And he left in a foul temper. I resolved to get up very early and dress and steal away. For if I was forced in some way to marry him, I would be dead and buried in one shake of a lamb's tail. As if he was suspicious of me at present, he would be more so later. And once he'd got me into a farmhouse, in a strange neighborhood with no friends about, I would not give two pins for my own life, as it would be a knock on the head for me and 6 feet deep in the kitchen garden, and I would be making the potatoes and carrots grow a great deal sooner than I cared to think. Happily, there was a door that latched, and so I latched it. And then I took off my clothes, all except my shift, and folded them neatly across the back of the chair as I used to do in the little room at Mrs. Alderman Parkinson's where I slept with Mary. Then I blew out the candle and slid myself in between the sheets, which were nearly clean for a wonder, and I closed my eyes. On the insides of my eyelids I could see the water moving, the blue heaps of the waves as we came across the lake, with the light sparkling on them, only they were much bigger waves, and darker, like rolling hills. And they were the waves of the ocean which I had voyaged across 3 years before, though it seemed like a century. And I wondered what would become of me, and comforted myself that in 100 years I would be dead and at peace and in my grave, and I thought it might be less trouble altogether to be in it a good deal sooner than that. But the waves kept moving, with the white wake of the ship traced in them for an instant, and then smoothed over by the water, and it was as if my own footsteps were being erased behind me, the footsteps I'd made as a child on the beaches and pathways of the land I'd left, and the footsteps I'd made on this side of the ocean since coming here. All the traces of me, smoothed over and rubbed away as if they had never been, like polishing the black tarnish from the silver or drawing your hand across dry sand. On the edge of sleep, I thought, it's as if I never existed, because no trace of me remains, I have left no marks. In that way I cannot be followed. It is almost the same as being innocent. And then I slept. This is what I dreamt as I lay asleep between the nearly clean sheets in the tavern at Lewiston. I was walking up the long curved drive to Mr. Kinnear's between the rows of maple trees that were planted on either side. I was seeing it all for the first time, although I also knew I had been there before, as is the way in dreams, and I thought, I wonder who lives in that house. Then I knew that I was not alone on the driveway. Mr. Kinnear was walking behind me, to the left. He was there to make sure no harm came to me. And then the lamp came on in the parlor window, and I knew that Nancy was inside, waiting to welcome me back from my journey, for I had been on a journey, I was sure of it, and had been absent a long time, only it was not Nancy but Mary Whitney who was waiting, and I felt so happy to know I would see her again, restored to health and laughing as she was before. I saw how beautiful the house was, all white, with the pillars at the front and the white peonies in flower by the veranda glimmering in the dusk and the lamplight blooming in the window, and I longed to be there, although in the dream I was there already. But I had a great yearning towards this house, for it was my real home. And as I felt that, the lamp was dimmed and the house went dark, and I saw that the fireflies were out and glowing, and there was the smell of milkweed blossoms from the fields all around, and the warm, damp air of the summer evening against my cheek, so mild and soft. And a hand was slipped into mine. And just then there was a knocking at the door. XI. Falling Timbers. The girl, instead of exhibiting any traces of broken rest and a guilty conscience, appears quite calm, with her eye full and clear as though she slept sound and undisturbed. Her only anxiety appears to get some of her clothes sent to her and her box. Of the former she never had but few. She wears at the present time the murdered woman's frock, and the box that she asks for belonged to the same poor sufferer. Chronicle and Gazette, Kingston, August 12, 1843. But though I have repented of my wickedness with bitter tears, it has pleased God that I should never again know a moment's peace. Since I helped McDermott to strangle Nancy Montgomery, her terrible face and those horrible bloodshot eyes have never left me for a moment. They glare upon me by night and day, and when I close my eyes in despair, I see them looking into my soul. It is impossible to shut them out. At night, in the silence and loneliness of my cell, those blazing eyes make my prison as light as day. No, not as day. They have a terribly hot glare, that has not the appearance of anything in this world. Grace Marks to Kenneth Mackenzie, as retold by Susanna Moody, Life in the Clearings, 1853. It was not love, although her rich beauty was madness to him, nor horror, even while he fancied her spirit to be imbued with the same baneful essence that seemed to pervade her physical frame, but a wild offspring of both love and horror that had each parent in it, and burned like one, and shivered like the other. Blessed are all simple emotions, be they dark or bright. It is the lurid intermixture of the two that produces the illuminating blaze of the infernal regions. Nathaniel Hawthorne, Rappaccini's Daughter, 1844. To Dr. Simon Jordan, care of Major C.D. Humphrey, Lower Union Street, Kingston, Canada West, from Mrs. William P. Jordan, Laburnum House, Loomisville, Massachusetts, the United States of America. August 3rd, 1859. My dearest son, I am in the greatest state of apprehension at not having had a letter from you for so long. Do send me at least one word to let me know that no disaster has befallen you. In these evil days, with a calamitous war looming ever nearer in the distance, a mother's chief hope is that her dearest ones, of which I have only you remaining, should be safe and sound. Perhaps it would be best if you would remain in that country to avoid the inevitable, but it is only a weak mother's heart that urges it, as I cannot in all conscience advocate cowardice, when so many other mothers will surely be prepared to face whatever fate may have in store. I do so long to see your welcome face once more, dear son. The slight cough, which has troubled me ever since the time of your birth, has increased of late, and is in the evenings quite violent, and I am in an agony of nerves every day that you are away from us, for fear that I should be taken away suddenly in the middle of the night, perhaps, without having the opportunity of bidding you at last fond farewell and giving you a last mother's blessing. Should war be avoided, which we must all hope for, I do so pray that I may see you well settled and in a home of your own before that inevitable date. But do not let my, doubtless, idle fears and fancies take you away from your studies and researches, and your lunatics, or whatever you are doing, which I am sure is very important. I hope you are eating a nourishing diet and keeping up your strength. There is no blessing like a solid constitution, and if one has not inherited it, then even more care must be taken. Mrs. Cartwright says she is so thankful that her daughter has never been sick a day in her life and is as strong as a horse. The inheritance of a sound mind in a healthy body would be the best legacy of all to leave one's children, one which your own poor mother was, alas, not able to provide to her own dear boy, though not for lack of wishing. But we must all content ourselves with the lot in life in which Providence has seen fit to place us. My faithful Maureen and Samantha send their respect and love to you and beg to be remembered. Samantha says that her strawberry preserves, which you loved so much as a boy, continue as good as ever, and you should hurry back for a taste of them before she crosses over the river, as she puts it. And my poor Maureen, who may soon be as crippled as your mother, says she cannot eat a spoonful without thinking of you and remembering happier times, and they are both most anxious for the renewed sight of your ever-welcome countenance, as is to a thousandfold extent, your always loving and devoted mother. Simon is in the upstairs corridor again, in the attic where the maids live. He senses them waiting behind their closed doors, listening, their eyes shining in the semi-darkness, but they don't make a sound. His footsteps in their thick schoolboy boots ring hollowly on the boards. Surely there ought to be some kind of carpet here, or matting. Everyone in the house must be able to hear him. He opens a door at random, hoping to find Alice, or was her name Effie? but he's back at Guy's hospital. He can smell it, almost taste it. That dense, heavy smell of damp stone, damp wool, halitosis, and septic human flesh. It's the smell of trial and disapproval.